obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Hello, everybody. My name is Hector, and I'm an alcoholic and a sex symbol. What? Why is everybody laughing? I mean, that hurts my feelings, you know. Even my best friend, Alba Francesca, she's not in the program. Once I told her I was a sex symbol, she looked at me and says, Hector, you're not a sex symbol, you're a sick symbol, Hector. Get it, you know. I want to thank Andrea for asking me to speak. She's a wonderful lady who had a great time. Also put a beautiful basket in the room. Dave Stephen for giving you my tape. Also, the people who put this convention together, like she said, it's a great deal of work, months of work. So let's give them a round of applause. I'm going to tell you my story. Remember, whatever I say from the podium is my experience and my opinion. Unfortunately, I happen to be very opinionated, and I may be wrong, but I'm never in doubt, okay? So, I was born in Argentina, you know. We were very, very, very poor. My parents were illiterate. They dressed badly. They were very violent, and they smelled even worse. You see, we have no bathroom. You know, poverty in America is middle class all around the world. You know, we had dirt floors, no bathroom, no running water, you know, no heat. And we lived really, really badly. And I was so ashamed of my parents, I never invited another kid to my house. I didn't want them to see how we lived. But I didn't know my parents, you know, I was an abused child until I came to AA. Here they gave you all kinds of problems, you know. I thought everybody gets chained to a sewing machine. You know, my mother used to chain me to a sewing machine. There was nothing personal, really. She also chained my kid sister and the dog. She was an equal opportunity chainer, you know what I'm saying? And I didn't mind that too. And by the way, this is what I'm going to tell you. It has nothing to do with my alcoholism, but I'm going to tell you this about my parents, because at the end of my pitch, I'm going to tell you how I healed that relationship with my parents, because that's what we do here, you see? We just had to live in peace. And so, and I hated my parents. I was so ashamed of them. I would never be caught dead walking on the street with them, you know. So she would chain me to a sewing machine, no big deal. My father was more violent, though. He would grab a knife or a gun in the middle of the night. We all run to the street. He was going to kill us. So my first dream as a child was not to be president of Argentina, a doctor, a movie star. My first dream as a child was to kill my daddy. What are you going to do, Hector, when you grow up? I'm going to kill my daddy. So, but I got very, very lucky. I got into sports and I became an athlete, and I was playing basketball. I was going to the gym. So I saved myself. And at the gym, a lot of kids from middle class homes went there, and I learned a great deal about life from watching them and going to their homes and see how they lived. They had bathrooms. They have, you know, faucets. You said, wow. And I used to go always to the bathroom to see, you know, because I didn't know this. They also have, you know, like a toaster in the kitchen. How magical is that? Wow, a toaster. So since I was a little kid, I used to collect American magazines and watch you people. And I knew I was coming here since I was 8 years old. I want to be with those people. And I used to look at the American magazine. They have bathrooms in America. They have beautiful bedrooms. They have cars. And they have lumberjack shirts. Nobody wears that in Argentina. And I wanted to get one of those, okay? So I saved myself by getting into sports, and I became an athlete, and I would, you know, come home from school, drop the books, and go to the gym. And my first dream when I was a little kid was to be the first white globe trotter. You know what I'm saying? That was my dream. And I used to practice for hours, had to do with a ball, you know, and I was very good, but I was too short and I couldn't jump high. So it was rather difficult, you know. So when I was about 24 years old, I came to America. And by the way, I came here legally, okay? So don't get any funny ideas. If you don't like my pitch, you cannot call immigration. I've been an American citizen now for 45 years. And I adore America, you know? I've been to about 20 countries, and I know that I'm living in this earthly paradise. I just know it. You know, after all, Alcoholics Anonymous was created here. And I remember when I landed in America in Miami, and we had a layover, so I got out of the airport, and I saw the parking lot. Oh my God, all these new American cars. And I walked around touching them. In this country, everybody's rich. You see, in Argentina, to have a late model car, American late model car, in 1961, you had to be a millionaire or somebody very rich. So I came to the right place. And from there, I went to New York. This stupid little kid from a little town in Argentina goes to New York. It was amazing. It's the tallest city in the world, you know. And I was really amazed by New York. I said, wow. And I began working really, really, really hard in New York. I worked in advertising. And, you know, only in this country, a little kid from Argentina can work. You know, I worked for a year and a half. And since I have no friends, you know, I'm always isolating myself. I saved a lot of money. And within a year and a half, I went to Europe and visited 9 countries. I was there 4 months and visited 9 countries. And I saw all the greatest art in the world, the statues, Michelangelo, Da Vinci, all the French painters. And I didn't know them, but I know now that I was giving myself an education. Because, see, in my house, there wasn't a single painting on the walls. When you don't have enough money to buy food, you don't buy paintings. You know, so I loved it. So when I came back, I was a little changed. I lost a little bit of the hick from Argentina. And I was working in this agency, and I wanted to socialize. You see, I wanted to socialize because it was very isolated. And they told me in order to socialize in the United States, you had to go to a bar. I'd never been to a bar. See, I was an athlete. So I'm very anal. When I do something properly, I want to do it properly. You see, when I came here, my first dream was to be a wasp. You see? But unfortunately, I had this big black afro about this big and a black mustache coming down to here. And no matter how I dressed, I always looked like a Mexican yuppie, you know? But I bought all my suits in Brooks Brothers. So I'm going to go to a bar. They told me where to go, and I do everything properly. I'm going to rehearse how to order a drink because I've never been to a bar, right? So I got in front of the mirror with my Brooks Brothers suit. Excuse me, please. Whiskey, please. Excuse me. Whiskey, please. Like a moron for half an hour, I was in front of the mirror rehearsing how to order a drink. Well, I want to do things properly. Like they told me to wear a suit to come here, I'm wearing a suit. So I walked into this bar on Madison Avenue, very shishy bar. You know, all the guys were tall, crook cuts, dark suits, ladies in beautiful dresses. When I looked at the guys, I said, they looked like a bunch of Mormons, you know. They were all tall, crook cuts, you know, dark suits. You see, the only Americans I knew in Argentina were the Mormon missionaries. They used to come to a little town to try to change us from unhappy little Catholics to unhappy little Mormons. And they were very nice, you know, but they used to kick our ass playing basketball. They were such great players, you know. So I thought of this, I didn't know the Mormons didn't drink, so I thought this was a Mormon bar, right? So the bartender with a crew cut comes over and goes, blah. See, English to us is like Spanish to you. When you don't, it sounds like gibberish. But I was prepared. I say, "Whiskey, please." And he looks at me, goes, "Excuse me, whiskey, please." Now, in hindsight, I realize he's asking me with soda on the rocks, whatever. I don't know caca, so I kept saying, "Whiskey, please." He got pissed, and he grabbed this little glass, a shot glass. I've never seen a shot glass in my entire life. and grabbed this funny bottle with a beak, and he poured this piss-like substance inside the little glass and put it in front of me. What's it give me such a little glass? And I looked around, all the Mormons had tall glasses. Well, maybe it's because I'm short, you know? I don't know, I've never been to a bar. So I drank the whole thing, I tried to act macho, right? So I drank the whole thing in one take. Oh, it was awful. Came out of my ears, my eyes, my nose, you know, I almost died. And this Mormon that was standing next to me, who looked like Gregory Peck in To Kill a Mockingbird, he said in perfect Spanish, ¿Por qué no prueba Cuba Libre? Why don't you try Cuba Libre? Yes, Spanish, easy to Cuba Libre, por favor, Cuba Libre. Rum and Coke. I loved it. I'm addicted to sugar. That's why I got to that program, you know. So, rum and Coke. I loved it. From then on, I drank everything with Coca-Cola. Scotch and Coke. Vodka and Coke. And then I graduated to my drink of choice, sangria and Coke. Wait until you taste it. You don't know. You see, I did not like drinking. I'm an athlete, you know what I mean? But I drank because I did not like Hector. I did not like Hector. You see, once I read that Leonardo da Vinci, who was a genius, said the perfectly proportioned man, and he was a genius, is 7 times the size of his head. So I measure my head. This is extra large, okay? According to that, I am supposed to be 7 feet 2 inches tall. So every time I looked at myself in the mirror, I saw the little midget with his huge head, you know? It's not funny, really. You see my nose? It looks like a bell pepper, right? I had a nose job. I'm the only person I know who looks exactly the same before and after. It's not funny, really. You see, I didn't like anything about Hector. I didn't like anything. And I began working really hard. You know, and I got myself a nice little apartment in Manhattan with a beautiful view, you know. I never had an apartment. It had a kitchenette, and it had a beautiful, beautiful bathroom. And I had achieved the American dream. I had a nice apartment with a beautiful view. I had Brooks Brothers suits, you know. I even got a piece of furniture from Bloomingdale's. And I still felt like a piece of garbage. And I did not know why. You told me why when I came here. You told me I was looking for a material solution to a spiritual problem. And you told me nothing, nothing that I see with my eyes can fix my insides. Nothing. Not the relationship, not the car, not the job, not the bank account. Those are wonderful things, and it gives me a comfortable life. But the solution is in this big book on page 45. You see, lack of power, that was our dilemma. Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to help you find a power greater than yourself that will solve your problem. And I did not know that. I thought because I had all this garbage around me, beautiful garbage, I was going to be okay, and I was not. And I began drinking, and I became an alcohol right away, because when I drank, I was tall, I was good looking, I spoke perfect English. I was a loud asshole, that's what I was. And, you know, and I got into fights and I got beat up and I was so depressed. I was always depressed. I have a PhD in depression. And I don't know why. I have all the things, you know. And I had my first suicide attempt. Don't ask me why. I'm very sensitive, you know. Maybe the doorman didn't say good morning to me. And I'm going to teach him a lesson. I'm going to kill myself. So I took about 40 pills. You know. Oh, by the way, I was not into pills. So no, but I always had 40 pills in case I wanted to kill myself. She said, I'm practical. You know, I'm practical. And it was fabulous. I took the pills. I always remember that. It was like a horizontal line coming down like this. Oh, this is good. I don't have to be tall. I don't have to be good looking. I don't have to speak perfect English. Of course he was good. I was dying. And then all of a sudden my friend Rudy calls me on the phone. And his wife had attempted suicide only a year ago. And within the 2 minutes he realized what I had done. He said, Hector, if you don't call me from the hospital in 5 minutes, I call the cops. Click, he hung up. Oh, my God. I want to be dead, but I don't want the cops in my house. How embarrassing is that? So I walked to Bellevue. It's 2 blocks away, and they pumped my stomach. Oh, the nurse says, what's wrong with you? Oh, I took about 40 pills. She says, that's stupid. Why do you do that? A nurse. So they pumped my stomach, and they made me see shrinks, and I saw a lot of shrinks, you know. And they couldn't help me because I never told them the truth. And I got more and more depressed, right? And I got a great idea. If all this stuff didn't make me happy, I know what's going to make me happy. If I become an actor and everybody adores me, I'm going to be great. I'm going to be okay. Okay? It says, and I was going to be the greatest actor who ever lived. I was going to do Richard III, Shakespeare in London, better than Laurence Olivier. That's kind of difficult when you can't speak English. So I became an actor, and I did a commercial, 2 commercials, 3 commercials. Oh, Hector, any idiot can do commercials. Even Joe Namath does commercials. No, Hector, you had to do theater. And God said, okay, little schmuck, I'll show you. And I got into this play at the Public Theater, and it was the best play of the year, and they moved us to Broadway. And I was on Broadway, this idiot who could hardly speak English, I'm on Broadway. I remember the first time, the first preview, I walked on the stage and I was so in awe, I forgot most of my lines. Oh my God, from Argentina to Broadway. Oh my God, we won all the awards on Broadway, including the Tony, which is equivalent to the Oscar in the theater. And I felt like a piece of garbage. And I don't know why. And I remember one afternoon, I woke up, I was sleeping on the floor, I had urinated on myself, you know, and I sat there, and I had a moment of clarity. We all do, don't we? I realized what my problem was. My problem is New York. This is a very hostile, unfriendly, violent place. I have to move to a more loving, caring, nurturing place. So I moved to Hollywood. You know, when I do this joke in Minnesota, they don't get it. And, you know, I came to Hollywood. I remember it's just nice, beautiful. And I'm taking a taxi to this little rinky-dinky little hotel. And I saw a pickup truck with one of those things they put it in the back, what you call them? Bumper sticker. He said, go ahead, honk again. I'm reloading. This place is not friendly. And I'm a Latino actor, right? I had the afro and the mustache, and I came to Hollywood, and I began doing a lot of television. I was always killing people, molesting women, selling children. Oh, my God. I was always put in jail. I was always handcuffed, you know. I guess that in so many shows, always handcuffed. I've been handcuffed on TV more times than the Menendez brothers, okay? So finally, I get this part in a TV show called Wanted, The Sundance Woman, which is the sequel to Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, right? With Catherine Ross. You all the guys remember the girl from The Graduate? Oh, my God, I'm going to be a good guy, and I want to ride the horse and save the girl. I'm not going to have sex with the girl. Progress, not perfection, right? So they give me the part. I audition. Then the director calls me home and says, Hector, can you ride a horse? Because this guy and the horse are like one unit. I said, I'm from Argentina. I was born on top of a horse. I lied. So we'll get to Tucson, right? And we're going to do the first, we do all the interiors. Now we're going to do the exteriors right around the jail and save Catherine Ross. If you ride properly, this is the horse, this is you. Nice. When I did it, it was like this. The director didn't think it was funny. Hector, why did you lie? This guy on the horse, like a one unit. I mean, he was born. Oh, wow. And he chewed me out in front of the entire crew. They forced me to practice for 4 hours. They wouldn't let me get off the horse. When I got off the horse, I couldn't get my legs together. I couldn't sit because my ass was a huge blister. So I go home to my hotel, right? And I get some half a gallon of sangria, some Coca-Cola. And I get a pissing drunk, right? And I return to the set the next day. I said to the director, excuse me, sir, I cannot do the scene. My ass is a huge blister. I said, Hector, we don't give a shit. You see behind you? It's 200 extras, Mexicans on horses. We cannot hire them tomorrow. You have to do it today. So what they did is, the Marlboro guys, you know, they put some wet towels on top of the saddle, right? And then the big guy sat me on top of the stupid horse. Now, I'm playing this heavy-duty macho bandito, right? Bullets, I have the mustache, I have guns, and I'm sitting on wet towels, you know? It's very embarrassing for an actor, okay? So they give me the guns and say, Hector, don't shoot the gun like this. Shoot only in the air. Because if I get you this close, I blow your eyes out. They're very, very dangerous thing, you know, the blanks. So the guy holding the reins is there, one of the Marlboro guys. They give me the gun. He says, I'm going to get one shot out. I'm shaking, I have a hangover. So I cock the gun and I hold it like this, and the horse goes, boom. Oh my God, I shot the Wrangler in the ass. He didn't think it was funny, okay? We do one take, and I'm an alcoholic, but I'm not stupid, okay? So I cock the gun again, and I put it next to my leg. And the horse goes, boom. Oh my God, I shot my leg. My costume is in flames. I couldn't care less. I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to save Catherine Ross. And I start galloping, and the flames start coming up and up. By the end of the take, it was like a torch on top of a horse. They got so scared, they threw me on the floors with blankets, you know, they put a thing on my, they rushed me to the hospital, they rushed me to L.A., and I had to be in the hospital for a whole month. That was my bottom, you know. I had to have two operations, one to remove the infection, one for a skin graft. While I was in the hospital, my agent didn't send me flowers. I'm very sensitive, remember? I'll teach him a lesson. I'll kill myself. I asked my friend Irene, you know, to bring me the pills. Remember, I always have 40 pills. I'm ready, right? And I took, by the way, I was not into pills, really. Only once somebody in the gym gave me one of those things, what's it called, Black Beauties? A lot of people are going like this, junkies. This is an AA meeting. So he said, if you take this pill, you're going to have a lot of energy, Hector. I love energy. So I took the pill. Oh, my God. I couldn't stop cleaning my apartment for 24 hours. I was dusting the ceilings, you know what I mean? The only thing, I couldn't close my mouth. Never again. Give me sangria and cocoa. Give me death. This is it. So anyway, that was my last and best suicide attempt. I was in intensive care unit for 3 days. I had three cardiac arrests, and they have to revive me twice. I was dead for 3 days, and I had everything. I just came from vacation. I have nice money. I have a brand new Mercedes. I have glorious, beautiful clothes. I had enough money in the bank to live for a whole year without working. One thing was missing. I didn't have Hector. I didn't know who I was. I was a pathetic little man with zero self-esteem. Tell me how high you want me to jump and I'll do it. I was just nothing, you know. And after 7 days, they sent me home, and it was too fast. It was too fast. I tell you how bad I was. I could not take the elevator because with the door closed on me, it would knock me over. And I've always been in great physical shape. That's how much damage I have done to myself. And within 9 months, I was doing the same garbage I was doing. And my shrink sent me to AA. He said, Hector, I think you have an alcoholic problem. You may be an alcoholic. Are you sure, Mike? Yes, Hector, I'm sure. Go to AA. And May 8th is going to be 35 years. And I love AA. I always say there are two kinds of people in AA, you know, the members of AA and the tourists, you know. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a sponsor. I sponsor people. I have three commitments. I pray, I meditate, and I work the steps. As a matter of fact, this Monday, I began taking a bunch of guys through the book. Some of you want to come to my small workshop, no more than 10 people. I spent 4 months taking you through a book, and I give you a system how to work the steps, and I give you handouts, and we do some writing, and every session we start with a prayer and meditation, and then we do work for an hour and a half, and we end up with prayer and meditation, and it takes me about 4 months. I love it. I love it. This is good. But, you know, Joel Goldsmith, a great spiritual leader, said anything we do in public, it's not that good because the ego is involved. When I'm working with you, just with you, it's just you and me. You know, and to me, the greatest thing is working somebody else. You know, because that's the gift. That's the gift. Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about recovery, you know. When I came to AA, I come from a Catholic background. I have a problem with God. You know, my God looked like Charlton Heston, and he behaved like Leona Hemsley. He did not like the little people. So I had to find, you know, a God that I could relate to. And I read a great deal of spiritual literature. And Joel Goldsmith said, regardless of how high my concept of God is, it is wrong, because it's still a concept. Eventually have to lose all concepts and reach the consciousness, like conscious contact, the consciousness that God is. And leave the subject alone, because with the mind, I'm never going to understand what God is. How can I understand a spiritual entity that takes care of 7 billion people at the same time? And the big book says the same thing on page 46. Even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power which we call God. And 53 says, we had to fearlessly face the proposition that God is everything or else he is nothing. God either is or he isn't. What was our choice to be? And that's what I believe that God is. You see, how can I define the spiritual entity when theologians and great religious authority have not been able to do it for thousands of years? That's why they say the mystery of God, the mystery of God. And you wonderful people, my teachers, you taught me, instead of trying to define God, try to see God in everything and everybody. That's what I was taught here. And also, I was taught here that for those who don't believe in God, no explanation will ever be sufficient. For those who do believe in God, no explanation is necessary. I'm so lucky I believe in God. I call God the power of the all good. You know, and the wonderful thing that when he says, the book says, God is everything. Think about that statement. God is everything. This podium, this clothes, this building, this table, your clothes, your shoes, the energy of God is everywhere present in his fullness. That means, and the book says where to find God. We page 55, we found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it's only there that he may be found. It was so with us. Think about that. Wherever I go, God is. This is a portable God. You know what I'm saying? I'm forever connected to the indwelling power of God. You see, and the wonderful thing about AA, this is a loving God. This is not a punishing God like Orthodox religion, you see. This is a loving God. Whatever I do, anything that I do wrong, God doesn't punish me. The fact that I did it, that's my punishment. There are consequences to every action that I take. And it took me a long term to learn about the steps. I took, Charlie and Joe 3 times, you know. And people say, work the steps to achieve sobriety. Yes, the end result of working the steps is sobriety. But do you notice that the word sobriety is not mentioned in the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous? The word recovery is not mentioned. Not even the name of our disease, alcoholism, is not mentioned in the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. But there's one word that is mentioned 9 times. That word is God. Alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful. But there is one, capital O, that has all power. Not 50%, not 90%. All power, may you find him now. And then they list the steps. So what I think, what I believe, that the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are spiritual tools to develop a conscious contact with God. The first step to have a problem, powerlessness. The second step says the solution is the power of God. The third step says I have to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. What is my will? You taught me. My will is my thought. The master said thousands of years ago, as a man thinketh in his mind, so is he. The big book agrees with that, page 23. The main problem of the alcoholic centered in his mind rather than his body. And that's totally correct, because this is a mold, okay? Whatever I put in here will manifest in my life. In my body, or in the situations in my life. If I think my life is a wonderful thing, that I can do all kinds of things, I will have a successful and peaceful and loving life. But I think life sucks. I'm too old. I'm too stupid. I'm too tall. I'm too white. I'm too black. Whatever it is, never will I accomplish anything. The universe says, granted. You know what I'm saying? So whatever I put in here will manifest. And what is my life? I did not know, but you taught me here. My life is my actions, the sum total of my actions. A man or a woman is not judged by what he says, how he dresses, how much money he has. He or she is judged by his actions. That's what Emerson, the great American philosopher, said. Your actions speak so loud, I can hear what you're saying. And isn't that true? The big book says the same thing. Action, action, and more action. And how do I turn my will over to God? And there's a book that they wrote by Hazelden, Drop the Rock or Dropping the Rock, whatever it is. And I read it, it was so boring. And But then they had just one sentence, and it made me understand. What does it mean, turn it over to God? Putting God first. That's what it means. When I ask me somebody, what do you think my God's will for me is in this situation? I always tell the guys the same thing. Whatever you had to do was in front of you, just do it with a lot of love. That's it. That's God's will for you. And then comes 4 and 5, right? And what is 4 and 5? The book says, I'm blocked from the sunshine of the Spirit. What are my blockages? My character defects. You see, 4 and 5 is a relationship with myself. I have to find out what is blocking me from God. So we do 4 and 5, right? And then comes 6 and 7. You know, we go home, we look what we have done. Is it really, have I really been honest? Did I do everything possible? And then if I think I did, I do 7. You know, I ask God humbly to remove this character defect. And when we do it in my house, you know, I make them do 2 lists. 1 with the character defects, 1 with the spiritual condition that I want to, you know, replace that. If I'm stingy, generous. If I'm hateful, loving. So I ask God to remove this and help me to move towards this list. Okay? And as I said, this takes me about 4 months. And then comes 8 and 9. 8, 9, 9 is my relationship with the universe. With all the people that I hurt when I was drinking. I had to make peace with all of them. Not for them, for me. Somebody said the other day, you know, hating somebody is too strong an emotion to be wasted on somebody you don't like.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
So we do 8 and 9. And when we do 8 and 9, there's a procedure, and they have to make a little card and write the name of the person or the institution or whatever, and then why he thinks that he has to do this amend. And he has to discuss each one of them with me, okay? Because some of them he may have to do it, some of them may not have to do it. I'll give you an example. Once this idiot came to me, and he's an engineer. Engineers are very good with the brain, but not very good with the soul, okay? Hector, I have 3 months sobriety. I already made 1 of my amends. You did. How bright. Yes, I told my wife that I had sex with a best friend. And Hector, she did not like it. No, moron, that's not an amend. That's passive-aggressive statement. If you did cheat on your wife, there is a living amend. You don't do it for the rest of your life. But that you hurt your wife. So please, you don't do or make any amends unless you talk to me. Okay? All of them. I don't care how little they are. Okay? Because I remember once I was in an argument with a printer, and I threw a box of cards at him, and I went to my sponsor. I said, you know what happened? This idiot insulted me, and they said this and this, and I threw a box at them. And my sponsor said, do you think you had to make an amend? Amends? He started the whole thing. I had to make the amends. You see, so, and after that comes 10. You know, 10 is a daily tool just to keep the channel clean. Because, you see, I have to clean the channel. Like, remember the St. Francis prayer? God, make me a channel of thy peace. So that's what I am, a channel through which God can shine. I myself can do nothing, but God can do it through me. And by the way, God cannot do anything to me or for me. He does it through me. You see, I'm just the faucet. I'm not the water. God works through me. I'm just a vehicle for him. That's why I have to unblock myself for all the poison that I have here so he can use me. So we did 10. So 10, we do it with the same, the same format for the fourth step with only one condition. Before I make the amends, I do 7. Whatever is the character defect that I practice in this situation, I ask, please, God, remove this from my life. And then I make the amends. And then he says in 10, right away, after I make the amend, go and try to help somebody else immediately. Why is that? Because I make the amends. Did I do it right? He didn't look at me right. He didn't even say, thank you. what kind of moron is he? You know what I mean? When you do, so immediately after I make amends to you, go and help somebody else. Why is that? I learned here that the only love that heals me is the love I give you. It's wonderful that you love me, but it's infinitely much important that I love you. That's why the book says, when everything else fails, it doesn't say go out and buy another cashmere sweater, does it? When everything else fails, go and find somebody else to help, to love, to care for. Khalil Gibran, the great poet, says, when we pass away, when we make the transition from the visible world to the invisible world, he says, when we die, the only thing we take with ourselves is what we have given away. And the most important thing we can give away is the gift of ourselves. Step 12, isn't it? You see, that's why helping others is so important, because I'm selfish and self-centered. When I'm helping you on you, you know, I'm not thinking about Hector. Okay? So then comes 11. My friend Harvey, who's British, you know, he speaks so properly. And he said, Hector, prayers, when you talk to God, when you hear the voice of God talking back to you, is called schizophrenia. I love that. He's a great speaker. You should have him here sometime. No, prayers just, you know, prayers is a dialogue with God, with the indwelling power of God. Remember, God is in here, not somewhere floating here, right? Pray, Hector, talk to God. And the book says, pray only for God's will and the power to carry that out. Why? Because I don't know what's good for me. I thought being on television, being at the Oscars, I'm a member of the Oscars. I was to the Oscars for 5 times, you know what I mean? Being on television, having the suits, having the house, and I had all that, and I ended up dead for 3 days in the intensive care unit. So obviously, I don't know what's good for me. Somebody said the other day, the most important things in life are not things. Wow. You know, so prayer is a dialogue with God, and prayer doesn't do anything to God. It does something to the mind of the one praying. The nature of God doesn't alter. It's always the same. Love. Because love is a fulfillment of the law. You cannot go any higher than love. And, you know, the most important we can bring to any relationship is love. And when is the time to love? Right now. And what's the most important we can give somebody that we love? It's time. Time. I can give you more jewelry, more, you know, watches, or 2 cars. But I cannot give you time, because when I give you my time, I'm giving you my life. You see? So when you work with a newcomer, you're giving him or her your life. Okay? So that's the most important. And then it comes to 12. Oh, I'm sorry. Meditation. Yeah, be still and know that I am God. Somebody said, be still and know that I am God. He doesn't say drive around in a BMW, eating a sandwich, talking on the phone, listening to music, and know that I am God. Be still, Hector. Be still. And let go of the world of conditions and circumstances, because I don't live there. I live in here. Be still. I was coming out of a spiritual lecture by Marianne Williamson, and there was a poster on the wall that says, most of men's difficulties come from his inability to sit by himself in a room for a while. Wow. Why is it that we are so afraid to be still and do nothing? Because we are trained, we have to achieve, we have to get this and get that. You know, and we have to find her or him, right? Because he or she is going to make us happy. And that lasts about 3 months. And then we discover who she is. And then we discovered that he's a real jerk, you know. So no. My peace has to come with a relationship with indwelling power of God. That's a relationship that counts. And by the way, the relationship I have with my higher power is the mold for all the other relationships I will have with anybody else. If I don't have a good relationship with my higher power, I will not have a good relationship with you. Okay? So, and then comes 12. We graduate here, newcomers, you know, when you graduate and get to 12, you get a title here. It's called Humble Servant. We're here to serve. Oh, I remember DJ was so nice to newcomers. When he spoke, I'm going to tell you, give you a message, newcomers. Stay with us. Nobody wants you anyway. Now, stay with us. Stay with us. We love you. You may have a family, but this is your spiritual family. We'll trust the road to happy destiny with you. We'll put our arms around you, and we'll dry your tears when you cry. We love you. We really know who you are. We really do. And you're most welcome. So we do service. We do service. Because that's a healing thing we do here. We do service. Service. Anyway, I talked to you about the steps, and I'm going to talk a little bit about my amends. Remember I told you I hated my parents? I detested them. I was ashamed of them. I wouldn't be caught dead with them. They were foreigners. They had accent. Oh, like me now, you know. And they dressed so poorly, you know, in that horrible house. But you told me that resentment is the number one killer, and it doesn't exempt parents. Kaka, kaka, kaka. You know. And somebody said, if you don't forgive your parents, you'll always have problems with authority figures. Your boss, a senator, your sponsor, the police, the president, because they all represent authority. And I have to forgive them, not for them, for me. Remember, resentment is the number one killer. Somebody said it so beautifully in AA. He said, resenting somebody is like a drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. Hector. And I had to look at my parents. Okay. My mother chained me a few times, and I'm not condoning that. That's wrong. But she also worked from 5 o'clock in the morning to 11 o'clock at night every single day of her life. There's no welfare in Argentina. Until then, there were no welfare in Argentina. And my father also worked every day. And we were still poor. She did some wrong things. So did I when I was drinking. Worst thing that my mother did, you know. And when I went to make my amends, I didn't want them to do justice with me. I wanted them to forgive me. You see? So I had to forgive them. I had to forgive my mom, not for her, for me. Remember, I have to clean the channel. So I thought about it. And you see, love is like any other subject. Unless somebody loves you and holds you and kisses you, you don't know how to do it to somebody else. And my mother grew up in Italy, and she had to kiss the hand of his father before going to sleep. She never went to school. Both my parents were illiterate, both of them. So nobody taught her, but she loved me. She just loved me. She sent me to school for 12 years. She sent me to take drawing lessons, you know, and she made some mistakes. And remember when I was 5 years old, we were very poor. We didn't have money for a Christmas tree. So she took a broomstick, some wires, some green paper, and she made a Christmas tree about this tall. 4 branches, 5 branches, 6 branches. And she went out with a quarter and bought 4 Christmas balls, different colors, and a point. But guess what? I had my Christmas tree. And she made some ornaments with her hand. She was very handy, right? And every year got a little bit bigger. See, she was doing the best she could with the tools she had. When I was 12 years old, it is a custom in Argentina to give the boy a bicycle. Remember, we were poor, very poor. But she saved and worked an entire year extra time. I didn't know it. And then, you know, Christmas Day, here I had a beautiful imported bicycle from Italy, metallic green. I had the best bicycle in the entire neighborhood, better than the rich boys. You see, she was doing the best she could with the tools she had. So I sent her a ticket to come to visit me in America. She had never been on a plane, and she flew to L.A., and she walked into my apartment, and she had a 12-foot-tall Christmas tree, real pine, decorated in her favorite colors, pink and red. And I had 33 presents underneath the Christmas tree, also wrapped in pink and red. We overdo things in AA. And I told my mom how much I loved her. And I thanked her for sending me to school, for buying me the books, for sending me to the gym, for buying me the gym clothes. I thank her for everything she did for me. Remember, she was illiterate, but she gave me 12 years of school. And by the way, I never, ever, I mention what she did wrong. We don't do that in AA. We take care of this side of the street. And I brought her back. I brought her back 3 years later with my sister Olga. And we made a bigger Christmas tree. And I took them every place, Disneyland, all the places. I bought all kinds of things. And I remember we had so much fun. We laughed so much, so much. And I remember once they were having a conversation around the table, Olga, my sister, and my mom. And my mom says, "Olga, you know what I wish for all the mothers of the world?" And Olga said, "What?" "That all of them could have a son like my Hector." And when she passed away at 91, my heart was at peace. I had no resentments. I had made my amends. And I realized that she, this poor little lady from Italy who never went to school, she didn't have to read and write, she didn't get a set of spiritual tools. She didn't get a sponsor or somebody to help. She did the best she could with the tools she had. And my heart is at peace. Now, when my father was a little more difficult, I left Argentina. I've been here for many years. I've been sober for 14 years. And he moved back to Syria and remarried to have other people. And all of a sudden, after 14 years, I get a letter from Syria. I said, "How you doing, son? I haven't heard from you in such a long time." "Of course you hadn't heard from me, dummy. I don't know where you were." And the letter says, "Oh, son, I just want to say hello to you and see how you were doing. And, one thing, I would like you to send me some money to pay my taxes." What? You write to me after 14 years because you need money? And, at the end of the letter, she says to him in the letter, "My family here says, you know, that if nobody talks to me from the other side of the ocean, I must have done something wrong. And if I did, I apologize." Ha! Ha! Did you do something wrong? And I began listing everything he did wrong. 1 page, 2 pages, 3 pages. Now I don't lie. I'm in AA, okay? And I keep writing and keep writing. And then I made a mistake. Newcomers, never do this, okay? I asked an old-timer what to do. And she says, Hector, would you rather be right or would you rather be at peace?
I'd rather be right. I waited 50 years for this shit.
But you know, guys, newcomers, be careful. They brainwash you here, okay? These people are dangerous, okay? So I send the letter, and I did not send, you know, the money. And I went back to the shrink who sent me here for 35 years ago. And after two sessions, says, Hector, you had to go to Syria and meet your father. You don't know your father. You never talked to your father. Your father never helped you with homework because he's illiterate. Syria? Are you crazy, Mike? Syria's full of Syrians. You know what I mean? They all look like my father. Oh, caca. So I call him on the phone. He didn't have a phone, so I had to call a place near him. They bring him to the phone, and he's senile. He sounds senile on the phone, begins to cry, and I said, Dad, I'll be there in 2 months. And I landed in Damascus. And this giant that used to beat me up, that was so afraid of, is about this tall. This little old man, wrinkled, bald-headed with wispy white hair, with baggy, funny pants, running towards me, sobbing. And he embraces me and starts kissing me all over. He's sobbing, and I begun sobbing. Why am I crying? I don't know this guy. People watching us are sobbing. I said, why am I? And then he grabs me by the hand, like I'm a 5-year-old kid, and put me in a taxi, and he takes me to his village, this very, very, very poor village. Syria is a very poor country. And, you know, taking me to his house. And his house is the only house that has a toilet in the bathroom. This is how poor this is. It's very poor. And he tells me his story. See, his father was about 17 years old. He never went to school. His mom was about 15 years old. She never went to school. My father was born. He grew up like a little animal in the village. He went to Argentina when he was 17, 18, and married my crazy mother. How is he going to know how to be a loving, caring, nurturing father? He had no idea. But he loved me. He really, really loved me. I just did not love him. I don't want an illiterate peasant from Syria. I want Bill Gates. Hell, I want crystal, Baccarat crystal, you know, a mansion. No. God said, Hector, this is your dad. Hector, this is the one you have to love, really, woof. And I spent the whole week with him. And he loved me so much, he made me dress in a 3-piece suit in this poor village. He bought steak, which is like caviar here, it's very expensive. He put it in front of me and made me eat it. And he invited all the villagers from the village to come in and say hello to my son, Hector, from America. And they all had to shake my hand. And the blind beggar, without shoes, smelly beggar, walk into the room, and my dad grabbed his hand to touch, he had to touch my face so that he too may know what his son looked like. That's how much he loved me. And I spent the week with him. I photographed him, I taped it, I talked to him, and I wrote. And then at the airport when I was leaving, I knew I was never going to see him again. And I said, Daddy, I love you very, very much. And I'm so proud that you're my daddy. He said, no, son. I love you 10 times more. And I'm so proud of what you've done with your life. I'm so proud. And this gift you gave me to come to my little village and visit me, no money in the world could make me happier.
And we sobbed and sobbed, and we hugged and hugged, and I left. And I came back to my country, the United States of America. And something very subtle had changed. I always looked like a man. I acted like a man. I sounded like a man. I dressed like a man. But inside myself, I always felt like a 12-year-old kid. Because you see, being like a man was being like my father. And I hated my father. I emotionally, when I came to AA, I was like, 40 years old. Emotionally, I was 12 years old. I was that infantile. And now, when I think about my dad, I smile. You know, the little guy did the best he could with the tools he had. And now I know what a real man is, or a real woman. You know, has nothing to do with what we drive, how much money we have in the bank, and that's all good. Prosperity is my divine right. But a real man or a real woman is somebody who is at peace with himself. See, the prayer in the St. Francis prayer, he says, the first thing he says, God, make me a channel of thy peace. That where there is hatred, I may bring love. That where there is darkness, I may bring light. But the first condition is to be at peace. And what does that mean to us in AA? That means we have made a conscious contact with the indwelling power of God. My peace doesn't come from the world. The world didn't give me peace and it cannot take it away from me. My peace comes from a conscious contact with this wonder that I have inside of me. You see, the secret of the spiritual way of life is this. Everything that I came here looking for, I came with it inside of me. Peace is inside of me. Sobriety is inside of me. Love is inside of me. Wisdom is inside of me. All those affable qualities that God has, I have. He is the Father. I am His Son. You see, I always tell people that God's grace is God's DNA inside of all of you, I tell them. And if that's too difficult to understand for us older folks, what is God's grace? It's the love of God forever reverberating inside of all of us. The gift is already given. I had to be gracious enough to accept it, you see? And I thought I was a piece of garbage when I came here. And I became the image you had of me. And all of us together are becoming the image that God has of all of us. That's what we are. The book says He is the Father, we are His children. God did not create garbage. All of us are a son or a daughter of the divine. That's the journey from the Hector I created, full of fear, you know, thinking he needs everything, to the Hector that God created, which is whole, complete, and needs nothing because the gift is already given. It's from here to here. It's a spiritual journey. It's a communion of our spirit, kindred spirit, like-minded people. The journey is to find God, that, and God will solve our problem. I love you. God bless you, and thank you.
Oh, my God. Wow.
Hope you have enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.